Welcome. I'd like to acknowledge the continuing sovereignty of all First Nations peoples right across the country. I'd also like to acknowledge elders, elders of the First Peoples of the land, and elders of more recent arrivals. Welcome to each and every one of you. And welcome to all our listeners tuned in across the country by the National Indigenous Radio Service and across the world by the World Wide Web. Welcome to you. It's great to have your company. Today, Amy McGuire joins me again, co-host of Let's Talk. How are you, Amy?
Yeah, I'm good. How are you?
Yes, yes, very well, very well. And today we have Geraldine Atkinson talking to me. She is the, talking to us, she is the Deputy CEO of SNAIC, the Secretariat of the National Aboriginal and Islander Child Care, which is the national umbrella organisation for all our child care agencies across the country. And it's also National Children's Day.
But Aboriginal first up, and Torres Strait Islander Children's Day.
National Aboriginal and Islander, National Black Kids Day today. All yep. right, all right. Geraldine, welcome to the program. How are you?
Oh, thank you very much. I'm good.
Good. Tell us your mob, your country.
I'm from down from around, well, my mother's from Cumbraganja Mission. My father was from Warringesda Mission. So I'm a Bangarang Wiradjuri woman. That's where I've lived all my life, around that area, when we moved from up in Leeton there.
All right.
But you're joining us today from Western Australia, isn't it? It's a bit early over there.
It certainly is. It's just after 7. Had to get up and get ready for this interview.
Yep. Well, we certainly appreciate your making the effort for us. And it is an important discussion. Our children and SNAIC and the agencies that are there to support our mob, our community, and our children. So we certainly appreciate you making the effort, Geraldine. Thank you very much.
Oh, you're quite welcome. And what you said is quite right. They're worth it. Our children are worth it.
They most certainly are. They are our future.
Yep.
And our elders are our link to our past. So we can't not acknowledge both. Can't acknowledge one without the other. Now, National Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Children's Day. How important is that? What does it mean?
Oh, look, it means quite a lot to SNAIC. We've instigated it since 1988. What we wanted to do was just highlight and profile children, because that's what our business is about. That's what SNAIC does. This year, our theme is Little People, Big Future. So each year we have a different theme. So what we want to do, we want to, you know, want people to think about supporting and celebrating our services that our little people go to. And we want to make sure that those services that we want to highlight this year, because we want them to be adequately funded to support strong development and learning and you know, all the other things that come with learning about your culture and your identity our little fellas now and our little fellas into the future.
And what sort of activities might take place? What might SNAIC be doing to promote this and to emphasise the importance of the day?
So what we do is we provide a lot of, what we do is we send out to all children's organisations and people, and by the way, it's not only Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander organisations, but a lot of other mainstream organisations too, is they buy our bags, and what we do is we fill them with a whole range of activities that children can do. So what's happening in a particular centre, the centre that that I run in Shepparton, is having a whole day today. They're inviting, 200 people, so all the services. They're inviting families. They're inviting, they're having activities for children. They have things like, it's a celebration, like a day that you'd have where they do face painting and they do dancing they bring a sort of animal zoo in to work with the kids. So it's a whole like you'd have a party. So it's a celebration, I guess, of what people are doing for National Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Day. So that's what we want people to do. We want to think about, as they're celebrating, we want to think about our children and about their futures and what is going to happen in this country for them.
When you talk about our children, our next generation, what would you say is the biggest barriers that are stifling that future?
I probably think that I think everything starts with education, really. I think if our kids have an education, have a good education. They start at the very at the beginning, and mind you, it's about education systems having to change because they have to make schools that are relevant to our kids, so that it, you know, it recognises their experiences and what they bring into the classrooms, and if what schools and what education systems are going to teach Aboriginal culture, and with that Aboriginal language, they're the sorts of things that need to be done. It needs to be not just done for our children, our Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children. It needs to be done for all children. What I'd really like to see is, you know, we should be about creating change in this country. We should think about decolonising the minds of these children when we get them into schools. So what they're thinking about just, you know, sort of a culture that's, you know, over 40,000 years old, that it's something that's to be respected, something that's to be celebrated, and that the kids that come into it, into schools, are to be honoured for being a part of it. So they're the things that what we need to change. There's things that we really should be working hard at doing. So making sure that we make schools, you know, places where our kids want to be, and so that they can get a good education, so that, you know, they can retain their culture and their Aboriginal identity, but get an education that's consumerate with, you know, the rest of the community, so they can enjoy. You know, we live in a society where we want things so that they can have exactly what everybody else does in this life: a good job, they have a good education, a good job, they can own their own home, raise their children, and participate, you know, in wider society as well.
While being strong in their own culture and identity
at
the same time.
Most importantly, yes.
I like your reference to we must have, these aren't your exact words, but a broader focus, not just on our own kids. This has got to be all kids of all backgrounds, all cultures. We've got to focus on all children, just like our struggle now. It used to be just focus on, well, for blacks, by blacks and stuff. It's got to go wider than that, you know. Focus and engagement has to be with people, with human beings, you know, more people. And your reference to decolonising the mind. Again, white people need to decolonise their minds every bit as importantly or as much as us blacks, because the whites are being screwed over with this colonial structure and colonial system. A lot of people seem to think that colonisation took place in the late 1700s and ceased somewhere in the early 80s or whatever, but they don't think that it continues on today, and that's one of the big issues. Colonisation is still screwing people over, the dominant culture particularly, and they can't identify it. Whereas easier for us as blacks to identify this colonial impact on us. But that dominant culture, they have a real difficulty in, until we bring it to their attention, that they need to decolonise. What are your thoughts?
I think that's exactly right. I think until that happens, that we're not going to move forward. You know, we're not going to change things for our children. That has to start happening. But, you know, when that happens, and I think that as I said before, we really need to start in schools, and really need to start with early childhood learning. That's where we need to start creating change. I'm a big believer of that we start at the very beginning. That's why, you know, we established the MACSs in the first place.
For sure.
So that we could teach our children about their culture and make them strong and proud.
That's very true. And talking today, I mean, we're based in Queensland, but you're obviously down in Victoria. But the Queensland government has actually put in a sizable funding commitment, $38.8 million over 4 years, which is quite almost astonishing when you think of past government allocations to 10 Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children and family centres, which has been welcomed by your organisation. Can you tell us a bit about the history of Aboriginal childcare centres?
Yes. We first started the multifunctional Aboriginal childcare centres in the early 1980s or middle 1980s, and I think there are only 30 of those throughout the country. And they were funded by the Commonwealth Government. What's NAIC had been doing right over the years, we've been lobbying governments, and particularly the federal government, to increase those services from 38 to more. So what we did get then was a national partnership agreement between the states and the Commonwealth for the establishment of those children and family centres that you've just spoken about. So there were, you know, states were allocated several of those each. In Victoria, we received two. In, you said in Queensland, there's eight. But so what happened when the federal government, when it changed, those services were no longer being funded by the Commonwealth because the National Partnership Agreement had ceased. So what happened, what we'd been really worried about, those services have been left floundering and we don't know how they're going to survive. Some of them had additional funds that they were able to carry forward. But in Queensland, that's fantastic news. And that's what we're saying that needs to happen. We've lobbied long and hard with the Commonwealth and they're not going to change their mind, so they won't fund them. I think we have to realise that. So that is great news that the Queensland government has taken up the slack and is funding those services. So what we need to do is we need to ensure that the two in Victoria, the state government takes up those in South Australia, Western Australia and the Northern Territory and Tasmania and New South Wales, they all those state governments, I think, need to take a look at what Queensland has done, take a leaf out of their book and fund those very essential services. They certainly need to be funded by the state because the Commonwealth is just not going to pick up funding them.
What's the outlook from the other states at the moment? Have they made any budgetary announcements or any outlook that they might actually fund those services, the childcare centres?
No. There isn't. There's always this argy-bargy that goes on between the states and the Commonwealth in relation to them. So it's easy to say, while you're not doing anything, to don't do anything really, nothing concrete about them. So I haven't heard anything from the other states to what's going to happen. There are things, I think, that are going to happen, but we're not sure at, you know, sort of what level. So it's for a lot of states, it's easy to think about, you know, sort of mainstreaming services than think about having specific Aboriginal services.
What's helped the Queensland government? What's got them to do this? And what are the services, the particular services? You mentioned in the 80s about childcare agencies, but childcare agencies were set up in the 70s. What's the difference?
No, they're the different. You're talking about the YACCAs.
Yes.
They're the Aboriginal Childcare Agency. So there's, what SNAC does, SNAC has sort of like two arms. What we do is we look after children's welfare. So we have one stream as the children's welfare. So we work with the Aboriginal Childcare Agencies. And the other stream is we work with early childhood education and development. So we have two lots of services. So that you're quite right. The ACCAs were set up in the 70s. I remember Molly Dyer when she worked so very hard in Victoria to establish VACCA. And then we had in the 1980s, we were able to, which are actually childcare centres, we were able to establish.
And so what's the Queensland government funding specifically? What are the services and how many of them?
What's
initiated this? Who's put the pressure on? They just didn't come out of the blue. Somebody must be on their case.
Well, it was probably we've been lobbying all governments to take over the funding for it. So we've been saying, you know, it's really essential that you do it. So we've been talking, you know, to whoever will listen really about these centres. But I would say perhaps the Queensland mob themselves must have done something as well to make Queensland government do it.
And what are the centres up here in Queensland? How many are there, and are they the early learning centres that you talk about?
Yeah, they're the early learning. You said there were eight to begin with,
There's 10 apparently that's been funded to get ongoing. Is there?
Okay. No, that's great. Well, if there's 10, that's great. So there's those. Those services are probably and probably, you know, what we've been saying to everybody is, you know, target your local members. We had, like, we brought people from the state, from all the different states into Canberra to lobby federal government. Then we said to them, go home and lobby, make sure what you do is lobby your state members about these services not being funded as well. So that's what hopefully is what they've done.
I'm interested in actually how the Commonwealth were let off the hook. And there's often, particularly from the Abbott government, talking a lot around school attendance and even past governments, you know, Rudd and Gillard and Howard looking at saving the children. What's the argument from the Commonwealth to justify handing these services over to the states and just pretty much dropping funding?
Well, that's what they say. They've just said that it's the state's responsibility, that they had a national partnership agreement that says that when they were established and when they used the funding that the Commonwealth had given them, that it was then up to that they were the state's responsibility, and they just wouldn't budge. They just would not budge. We've tried and we tried, and they just still haven't budged. So they have not got any commitment to. They don't even see that. Early childhood education and development, as any, you know, childcare. They see childcare services as childcare. That's all it is about child minding. It's about what they've done. You look at their new children's policy about having nannies, about funding nannies, millions of dollars. You know, our early learning, our childcare centres. I think it cost us about $60 million a year to operate in relation to the hundreds of millions that they put into other services for childcare. So that, no matter what they say in relation to we should be doing things for children and we should be looking at improving education, we should be doing a whole range of things. So it's easy to talk, but it's harder to walk. What governments won't do is they won't really make a really strong, dedicated commitment to ensuring that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander kids have good lives or good education or good whatever.
What's the engagement by our mob in communities, parents, or the interest and the support for parents to have our children in childcare or early child development?
No, the support's really good. Listen, in all the time that I've worked, all parents, and I don't care, all parents, when they have their children, they want what's very best for their children. Mm. They do, no matter what. But then life comes along and knocks them over and does whatever to them, and it's really hard for them to get up and ensure that what's going to happen to their children, that the children are going to receive the best. But things are changing, and we're getting a lot of parental engagement, particularly in our service that I mentioned in Shepparton. We have parents come, to all the events that we have. At the end of the year, we celebrate, our little kindy kids going into school, and we have a big celebration. It's like a graduation. And, we have wall-to-wall parents at those things. So I think it's changing. In the past, that would not have happened. Going back a few years ago, parents give you their kids and say, you look after them for the day and that's it. But it's no longer the case. I think more and more, the more things are happening, the more that you empower them, the better that they are about participating in their kids' education.
In other states, do you see a situation where these childcare centres will just pretty much just be gone because of that lack of funding commitment, and it may only be Queensland that we have?
No, that's right. I think that's a possibility. They could just fall over. If they don't have the funding to, if they don't have funding or they don't work out a way that they're going to be sustainable, then that's a very real threat that they could fall over. Yep.
That's very sad. And when you think of Victoria, even Queensland, 10 seems such a small number. If you think of Victoria, 2 childcare centres in the whole of Victoria,
Well, we've got 2 children, and I've got to say, there's 2 children and family centres, so that's 2 Aboriginal specific children and family centres, which is as different from the centres that I talked about that were established in the 80s. So we've got five of those. So in total, we've got 7, but they're funded differently.
Yeah, right. Mm.
Yeah.
Okay. So it's still not a lot, isn't it? We should be actually investing in more.
That's right. I think it's really great that the Queensland government has done this, and I think that particularly at this time where we've seen the Commonwealth has been just you know, absolutely abhorrent about. They've been appalling, really, in relation to Aboriginal funding, Aboriginal organisations. They, you know, sort of what's happened with the Indigenous Advancement Strategy and about the number of mainstream services, you know, AFL and NRL, yes, and all, yes, those other services,
oh, yes,
received a whole range of funding.
Yes.
Yeah.
And you know, Aboriginal organisations have received a pittance. And you can see, starting now, you can see the effects that it's having on some services, about having to sell off assets, you know, to maintain their services, to having to let staff go. So they're real things that are happening in community. And now that's the commitment that the federal government has had to Aboriginal affairs. And I don't think, you know, and it's no good sitting back and waiting for change of government or anything. I think that what we need to do, what needs to happen, is we need to start saying to state governments that you have a responsibility in this area as well, yeah, and that you're going to have to take up that slack where, you know, sort of where the Commonwealth is just not coming to the party. It's just exactly what's happened there in Queensland. So that, you know, I can't say, and I suppose I've probably said it a few times now, that just how great that is.
Yes, no, it's... And the feds can't be... Well, the state governments can't be let off the hook, as in other cases other than Queensland. And the feds, yeah, I mean, they have created a monster with the Indigenous Advancement Strategy. There's no question about that in a way. I think it feels to me, I don't know how you feel about it, but it appears to me, Geraldine, that our cause has gone backwards to some 50 years or more, this mainstreaming, this assimilationist policies and programs. It's moving forward in a big way, and we have to try and maintain our position and the wins that we've had over the last 50 years or more.
That's right. I agree totally. That I think that it has. I think that, you know, when you look at it, you think about kind of leadership within your community and within your state, and then you want to look nationally. And I think that we just haven't got it. I think that we have, whether, you know, sort of like that fire in the belly from years ago where people fought really hard.
You hit the nail on the head there. Oh, you hit the nail on the head. I mean, a lot of us had the fire in the belly. Now we've got more belly than fire, like me, you know. We've got more belly than bloody fire. Yeah, 30 years ago we had plenty of fire and little belly, no belly. And for me, speaking from my own experience, more bloody belly than fire these days, I think. And
I still reckon you got fire.
But you're right. The leadership, Geraldine, is our bloody problem. It's our issue. It's the leadership.
Yes.
Yes. No question about it.
No. And that's
how do we resolve that?
I think it's lacking. I think, you know, well, what I want to do in my own community, you know, is work with our young people and make sure that they've still got it about. And it's about teaching, you know, it's about for them to being strong in their culture and about understanding that and about realising that they haven't, that there's still a fight there, that they still have, there's things that they have to be involved in, you know, making sure that they are involved in things, that they are out the front saying those things, that we need change and why we need change and why we need things to be better in communities for our mobs. That's what still needs to be saying, and we need to be training, I think, you know, in our own communities, our young people to get up there and, you know, have a go. You know, that's, I can remember my brother when I was young. I don't know whether you knew him at all, Tiger, but Alf Bamblett. He said
knew him real well, yes.
That's what he said. You get off your mum and you get out there and you have a go and you work for your community.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Geraldine, what is it that we have achieved? I mean, a lot of our mob, it's too easy to focus on the negative and say we've gotten nowhere, we're going backwards by 50 years. But there have been some wins, there have been some achievements, and the fact that we still have these community-controlled organisations and national networks of community-controlled organisations, the fact that they're largely still in place, they have changed somewhat due to squeezing by federal government funding agencies and what have you. But what At your perspective, at your level, what are the wins that we need to focus on? What are the achievements to focus on and continue to push forward? Rather than throwing our hands up in the air in a sense of hopelessness, what do you see as the wins? What are the achievements that we've been able to celebrate and should continue to celebrate but pursue more?
Yeah, I agree totally with you. We have had wins. I can just let you know, in Victoria this year, we I can remember when I first started working in education in Victoria, going back to the 1980s, you know, we'd only had, you know, the ones or twos or the threes, and we'd get up to perhaps 10 throughout the state completing year 12. This year we celebrated a group, you know, a group of 512 young people that had completed year 12. Wow. And they were Aboriginal, and they were, and what they wanted to do was they wanted to identify as being Aboriginal.
Right.
Now, I really believe that's a win. You know, years ago, they, probably half of those kids would have hidden within, you know, hidden away and not wanted to identify as Aboriginal. So that this is 512 young people completing year 12 and proud of being Aboriginal,
that's
wanting
fantastic.
To identify as being Aboriginal. Now, I really believe that's a gain.
For sure.
That's what we have to do. We have to make sure that what we're doing is, you know, that's half of our kids in Victoria, half of our year 12. So we need to get the other half there as well. So we need to be, as you said, we celebrate the gains, but we have to realise that we've still got work that needs to be done. So it's about making sure that we have, you know, so that we have these services still operating, that we still have those, like here in Queensland, those children and family centres. That's a gain.
Yep.
You know, that's a really big major gain about having those multifunctional Aboriginal childcare centres operating. That's our next fight. It's about fighting with the Commonwealth Government how they're going to be funded. So what we have to do is we keep having to say that we do have gains in community. You know, we have services. We're getting our young people employed in a whole range of other services. So I'm not saying that everything is negative. I'm not saying that that's the case. But we can't afford to let our foot off the pedal. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
We have to make sure that we have our. Well, we're working really hard to ensure that we sustain, and we not only sustain and maintain, but we improve and achieve a whole lot of more gains.
You mentioned leadership, lack of leadership. This is all part of it, isn't it? Having these young ones come through with an education, having them wanting to identify, they must be strong in that identity, but that's where the leadership comes from. And we that are heading up organisations and agencies and services must make room for these young ones coming through now. That's part of the development, the progression of our struggle.
It is. And do you know what, Tiger? I know, you know, sort of, I've got nothing against leadership programs and what that are run out there, and they're great. They're, you know, those things that the government do. But I think that what you're saying is true. It's in communities that we have to take on. We have to, you know, the older fellows have to take on mentoring young fellows in communities and getting them to work. That's where, you know, down there on the ground, really getting in and working in communities and seeing how decisions are made and how you negotiate with government.
Black politics, learning black politics.
Oh, that's exactly right.
So that's
what needs to happen. But, you know, that's where we need to be saying, you know, I talked about the fire in the belly. That's what we have to do about these young fellows.
That's right.
Make sure that they get it, that it's passed on to them.
I agree with your comments regarding leadership. I mean, sure, they're fine, but Geraldine, they're following in white fellows' footsteps. It's white fellow terms of reference. It's white fellow leadership.
We didn't
have that before white fellow come along. And it's important that the mentoring, the bringing the young ones through. I mean, certainly go along to those white leadership things. You'll learn something. You'll come away with something. But that it's all on white terms of reference, and that's where the issue lies for me.
Yeah, and that's right. Well, you can go there and you can learn, but make sure that what you're learning is you're going to use to what, you know, you turn it around and use it how it's going to be best used in your community.
Most certainly.
Yeah.
When we're talking about the family centres, I mean, you look at the high rates of child removal. I think Aboriginal children are 10 times more likely nationally to be placed in out-of-home care. How important are those family centres to potentially lowering that contact with the child protection system?
I think they're really important because what these services are, and that's what all those early childhood all services should be, and even with our Aboriginal childcare agencies, what we should be doing is we should be providing an integrated wraparound service for our families, particularly, you know, we in our communities we can identify who are the most vulnerable, you know. So what we need to be able to do, so within those communities and within those services, you need to be able to provide sort of wraparound holistic services for them, so that you've got them coming into your service. You're looking after the children. You're providing the parents with some, coaching and how on, good parenting practice. You're providing, classes so that you can do things like nutrition and about, sort of a whole range of things. Because, sort of like, and I keep talking back, and I can only kind of relate to the service in Shepparton that we've been able, and it's about being able to build partnerships with other organisations as well. So it's about making sure, sort of we have access to the food bank, so there's food there in the foyer. Parents can just help themselves. If they need, sort of help with relationships, that you'd be able to get them onto other networks that work in those areas that do things like that. If they need respite from their children, about organising, working with the other organisations, Aboriginal organisations, about ensuring those sorts of things happen. There are a whole range of things. If they, if people, and I don't believe, sort of when if they're parents, what they want to do, as I said before, they want what's best for their kids, and sometimes they can see no way out of, the rut that they've got them into. So it's about if these services are assisting them, they can, pull them up out of that rut and show them that there are, there are other ways and means and things that, they can be doing with their lives and get on and rearing their kids, properly. Or, what I'm saying is rearing them so that they're still at home, that they're not being taken into out-of-home care. And what you're saying is that, at the moment, that's what's happening, that the numbers are increasing, unfortunately, with children being taken into out-of-home care. And we need to make sure that what we're doing in communities, we're working on, that we're applying prevention measures so that we don't have to put so much money into, in intervention and into children in out-of-home care, that it's going back, that it's in community, and that it's community working with community to make kids stay in community is what we really need to be doing.
It's really sad, isn't it, to think about that, because the problems are fundamentally with the child protection system in itself, isn't it? And the onus is placed back on Aboriginal communities.
I really believe, sort of what I talked about before, and it's true, I really believe that the numbers are really high, and you've got to think, sort of the high. We want, don't get me wrong, children need to be safe. I really believe that children, that's paramount, that children have to be safe wherever they are. But what I really think that's happening is we have, when you think about, sort of what's happening within, who's making those decisions about children being removed from their families, sort of they're usually white middle class social workers that have, we talked about, I said earlier about decolonising minds, that they still really, they've got, sort of, and I think, I wished I could quote it for you, but there was a study or someone was doing a PhD and they did some sort of study about, the same situation between an Aboriginal person and a non-Aboriginal person. And they were much, sort of with the non-Aboriginal person, they were saying, they would work things out and do this, whereas with the Aboriginal person, they'd remove the children immediately just because, they're Aboriginal.
Yeah, wow.
What? And look, there is a study, so I'm not just making that up, but I couldn't tell you what it is, okay?
Now, that's really amazing, yeah.
Yeah, so these are the sorts of things that we have to start thinking about is why, and I know that, it's easier to look at what's happening, but, look at, it's their ideas about Aboriginality and about what that entails. So what we have to, what they also, and Tiger mentioned this before, we have to start changing their mindsets so that they understand, so that when they're looking at our children and what's happening and they're seeing, they see a totally different story. So a lot of our children are moved because of neglect. A lot of our children are moved because of, and a large number is about family violence. So what we need to be doing is we need to start working with families. That really needs to be what's happening. So, and the money's drying up. The money, the federal government's closing their purse strings tight. We need to be making sure that what we do, and if they don't do it, well, we need to be looking at state government, or someone has to do it, so that we're looking at families, so that, and there's a big emphasis on family violence at the moment everywhere. So what we need to be looking, if they're the major drivers for children being out of home care, then we have to start looking at how we can fix that in the homes so children remain at home.
Yeah, that's very true. I remember just listening to, particularly when there was a lot of protests around the grandmothers against removals earlier this year, and I think there's a parliamentary inquiry into out-of-home care, and it was really interesting seeing the differences, the stark differences in the testimonies between grandmothers who'd had their children take, their grandchildren taken off them, and bureaucrats who have all these policies at the high levels, but it just doesn't seem to filter down to the bottom. And the experiences are so different. You know, you can put these policies in place and yet they don't seem to be actually acted upon. Things like the Aboriginal Child Placement Principle. And
that's exactly right. But, you know, it's those, and you can have, and it's always that. At the higher level, no matter where you can make, that's where, and it's probably Tigers, probably, you know, where you've been able to negotiate and make things happen with policies, you know, with policy changes and everything. But when it gets down to, you know, down right down to the frontline services, where they don't put it into place, it's where those, where we have to start changing those mindsets of those people about how they work with community. So it's really they're the people that are making the decisions about the removal of children. We could have all the best policies in the world at the hierarchy, but unless it filters down and it's those frontline people have to understand and realise that what's in place, well, then we won't get change. So that's where it has to happen. That's where you have to start making changes.
Is there an issue with numbers of our mob, our families, like that can be regarded or registered carers or classified as good people to be carers and stuff like that?
Yeah, we do. I couldn't tell you the numbers. I'm not really sure.
Is there a shortage there? Is there an issue there with lack of?
No, there's always a shortage. Mm. There is a shortage. There's always a shortage of families that about taking children into care. But that's the next best step. If you can't, you know, sort of, if we can't have children home with their parents, and the next best thing is to be in kinship care. So with, you know, with a grandmother or with an auntie or with somebody that's, you know, close to them, so that they're still, and what we say is we should still have our children home in their communities, no matter if they're in out of home care.
Yeah. Mm.
And we want, you know, sort of, you know, we want them attending those children and family centres and those MAC services, because that's where they're still retaining their attachment with community. And they're still retaining, you know, sort of with that, with their own cultural being, you know, sort of being able to understand being with their own people. Mm.
Is it an option to establish community caring facilities? It might be like a boarding school type thing, but some sort of a facility where there's a number of children taken care of by with a structure in place where there is First Nations people that are the house parents, the managers, the administrators, and the children are in a safe place. And there's more than one family. It's catering to more than one family. It's catering to the education, to the cultural identity development, and all of these sort of things. Is that an option? Do they exist? Or are we just dependent upon independent family situations and family homes to be able to make room for another child that may not be theirs or might even be a member of the family?
Well, they did. I know that they did exist, you know, years ago, because of their, it's kind of like residential care that are run by Aboriginal house parents. There is actually one in Melbourne that the Victorian Aboriginal Child Care Agency operate. But the majority, but there aren't a lot of them, no.
Is it an option? Is it a realistic option or something, a viable option, I suppose, really? Is it a viable option?
It could be. Mm. It could be. But once again, it's about having the funds to able to do it. And that's what it all comes back to, unfortunately.
It does. Yes.
Mm.
A lot of money put into taking children away all the time and none on issues like this, you know.
And exactly. A lot of cases, Geraldine, it's there's no guarantee that the children are being placed in a safer place than where they're being taken from.
Which is so very true. If you look at, you know, sort of, and we do know, you know, people know, we know, we've heard of, you know, stories and instances where we can say that children that have been taken in about our own care have not been safe.
Yep.
You know, so there have been, you know, appalling things happen to them. So it doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, being taken there taken away and put into, you know, mainstream foster homes is better for them. I think to me that it's always a gamble. It's a gamble. We're gambling with our children's lives.
And when you talk about futures, I mean, just getting back to the theme of the day, little people, big futures, I mean, taking children away completely wrecks their future in a way because they're just so much more likely to end up in jail on remand.
Yep. No, that's exactly right because that's, you know, that's what they say. That's what the figures, the statistics have shown, that children that have been in foster care are most times more likely to end up in juvenile justice, and then from there they progress to jail. So that's so very true.
Snake has a campaign called Family Matters, doesn't it? Can you tell us a bit more about Family Matters?
Well, we're looking at talking to, you know, communities that are having, we've held forums throughout, you know, different states, looking at bringing people together. It's about talking about just precisely what we've been talking about with children in out-of-home care and talking with community about how best we can, you know, we can divert children from going into out-of-home care and our community would best work with them. So that's what we're doing. Sort of we've been going throughout the state doing, talking to communities about these, in particular these issues and how best, what are the best strategies that can be employed to ensure that families are working better and that we are making sure that we're keeping our children from going into out-of-home care. So it's about looking at that and looking and actually working, you know, sort of with communities with what strategies they think might best work. Yeah.
Yeah, I was actually looking at some of the state and territory breakdowns because I think you've only visited South Australia, Western Australia and Northern Territory so far on the website. Yep. But I'm continually shocked by the Northern Territory, particularly 33% of the population and an 33% of Aboriginal children are Aboriginal in the population, but 83% are taken away. That is just, I mean, more than any other state, I just find that so incredibly shocking.
It is shocking. And I actually attended the forum in the Northern Territory and I could have cried with just hearing the stories that, you know, local people had come and would come and tell about just why their children were ripped from them. And taken, and you wouldn't thought you know, you sort of. And Tiger, when he first talked there, he said something about this, you know, children being stolen, and that's what listening to these stories was exactly. You could the heartbreak of those mothers that were telling their stories about how their children were taken from them, and what they were doing, and you just wonder, you know, looking at them, you'd wonder why would anybody want to take their children from them.
Yeah, so I think the Queensland figure is something like 40%. Of the children that are in care, 40% of them are our kids.
Yeah, and I think someone was saying here we're in WA because you know that's what we're doing today is we're launching National Aboriginal and Islander Children's Day here in Perth. That someone was saying that it was over, with, and I'm not sure about this, but I'm somewhere up near about 50%.
Yeah.
You know, the children that are in out-of-home care are Aboriginal.
Yeah, when you look at state and territory breakdowns, it's even worse than the national breakdown. Yeah. It's just...
So there's a big demand or a big need for us as First Nations parents, carers, grannies. We've got to make a bit more of an effort. We've got to do more to try and nip this in the bud. It's not good enough to try and deal with it after the children have been taken. We run around in a panic and, oh, look, they're in a white family. We've got to organise. We've got to get them back to family. We've got to do things beforehand, and that is try and organise in community so that family matters. I mean, it's a great term. Family does matter. Yeah. Without family, we're lost sort of thing, you know. And we've got to make that count. Family matters. That's got to be, I think, a focus for us all on the ground in our communities, in our homes.
What you're saying is true, and what we need to do, we need Snake needs support from all the other national organisations as well. Snake needs support from a whole range of local Aboriginal, you know, organisations and communities. We need to, what you're saying is there, it needs to be highlighted, and everybody, you know, everybody, it's escalating, you know, the situation is. So I think it needs a whole of community, and that's talking, you know, the local level, the state and the national level, about looking at how we can best address and make sure that we don't, that, you know, our kids, that the numbers don't escalate any further.
Yeah.
We make sure these kids are home, safe in community.
Yeah.
I want to raise something else. I don't know if you actually saw it, Geraldine, but Andrew Bolt wrote on his blog just, I think it was last week, talking again about the myth of the stolen generations and named 10 stolen generations children. And I don't know what provoked that. I think it might have been something with Adam Goods. But the fact that we still have racists out there talking about the stolen generations could have been a myth. Do you have any hope that Australians could actually see the high rates of Aboriginal child removal in a similar way, that they would actually care enough to look at it in the way that we know that it's a complex issue? It's not just Aboriginal families can't look after their children.
In a way, they might say to Bolt, get down off your high horse, you clown.
Yeah, or even
stop the documentation and the statistics and there that is put in place by mainstream experts authority. These are government figures. We're not creating the figures ourselves.
No.
And he's denying those statistics.
They denied the race wars. They denied everything. They denied the massacres. They denied whatever.
Yes.
And but we, you know, like, it was really interesting because what somebody else says, I'm not going to say who it was, but a high profile person who was just stood down from their position, we'd lobbied, you know, in her office, and what she said to
I wonder who that was.
What she said to our group was, get over the stolen generations.
Yeah. Did she say that?
Yeah.
Yeah, just get over the stolen generations. Mm. So, you know, when we get people like that that are governing our country, and we get people in, you know, like who allow the, you know, the right for a newspaper that has those opinions, and we've still got people like that that I think that are fanning the flames, fanning, you know, against Aboriginal people, acceptance, Aboriginal people's, you know, cultures about accepting how we are accepting. We should have the right to retain our identities as Aboriginal people, no matter what. We don't want to be carbon copies of white fellas. We want to be Aboriginal people working and living in this country that was ours in the first place, and but you know, enjoying what everybody else does within it.
Geraldine, in winding up, I'd like to say we cannot be carbon copies because white occupation has not established any great examples of humanity, survival, sustainability, call it what you like. They have not created any great examples. In fact, it's been the opposite. So we cannot go down that path. We've got to maintain our culture, our cultural integrity particularly. But look, we've got to go.
And maintain that for our kids.
That's right. That's right.
Yes.
Thank you very much for your time with us. We really appreciate
the
chat. And we should make a habit of having more chats with Snake.
Okay, then.
Thanks for that.
Thanks for having me, you guys. Okay. Bye.
Have a great day. Bye now. Geraldine Atkinson, Deputy CEO of SNAICE, the Secretariat for National Aboriginal and Islander Child Care. Amy, it's time for the river story. Are you ready for it?
Yeah, best part of the day.
It's a good one. It's a good one.
The farmers tried producing and storing the healthiest of the seeds for replanting in ever-increasing tracts of country. This did not cause undue alarm amongst neighbouring clans because initially the totemic networks experienced little stress. But neighbours did not understand the dark rewards these planters sought for their dreams of power and privilege. Some of my thinkers believe the natural environment provided inspiration. In particular, if often very young, some species exhibited telling behaviour. When certain eggs hatch, it was noticed that some chicks determined their parent was the first moving creature they spied. Thus, if the natural parents were to be removed for some reason, even humans could become mother to different species. Perhaps children could be taught subservience if separated from parents and family or adopted by a farming family. My writer mentions today's example of an orphaned piglet, which might become convinced it is a dog if adopted into a litter of pups. But of course, it is always a pig. It just has restricted knowledge and experience of living as one. Driven by their dreams of power, the farmers groomed followers openly and covertly. Ostensibly, the aim was food production. Eventually, the concept of tilling soil became more clearly understood as a threat to the people's congenial relations with land and others. Children could articulate this level of knowledge, meaning the issues were clear-cut among the groups affected. But sufficient rewards beckoned to change relations with land from respectful and spiritual to competitive and profane. From deep immersion in their environment, humans had no reason to restrict diet to what agriculture might or might not provide. Thus, the element of force emerged as necessity for those who aspired to subjugate their fellow humans. The problem for the would-be farmers was not so much that they thought tilling soil would provide more food or even any certainty of it. They wanted to dominate the lives of people. If other traditional food was displaced by clearing land for agriculture, any crops grown might feed the people. Opponents pointed out that the rains are not predictable. Therefore, when dry seasons come, alternative species will be restricted by land clearing. So the people will be worse off and on limited diet even during good seasons. The logic of this reasoning exposed the unsound dreaming of the early farmers. However, the tillers' logic was sound in their own minds and hearts. By eliminating other food species, the specter of starvation would make their crops indispensable to survival and give them great personal power over all those disadvantaged. The discussion spread through a few close networks where gradually weakening totem and kinship ties produced a certain laxity of mental discipline and accountability. The talk of new methods and huge surplus food production also spread through my area, but people were more amused than intrigued by the ideas. My country provided through good times and bad. Remember? Shadow talk from the dark side of humanity gained small foothold among clans in my basin land. However, a buffer zone developed around the affected areas, insulating the farmers from forceful discussion outside their block of clan groups. After some generations, larger numbers of people existed within clan boundaries, but they were vulnerable to the influence and power exerted by the farmers who owned the surplus food, and the ancient knowledge was becoming lost to the people.
The River Story. Amazing, amazing. Let's hope you're enjoying it. Amy, tomorrow we have Noel Pearson on. I'm not too sure whether it's phone or live in the studio.
That'll be interesting. He's been in the news quite a bit and also just been up at Garma where Abbott has sent through a letter to, I think, Dodson and Pearson about constitutional reform and basically knocking back any suggestion of Indigenous conferences. So in my mind, that means he's just not interested in getting any Aboriginal opinion or Aboriginal consensus on the issue of constitutional reform. So
be interesting to see what he's got to say.
Yeah.
Time for us to go. Make sure you join us tomorrow with our discussion, for our discussion with Noel Pearson.